Hello, hello, hello. I'm your Electra hostess with the mostest, Michael Munoz, and welcome to In Yo Mouth.
In Yo Mouth.
I'm the queen of food who's always in the mood
to lick it right, lick it good, show you how to
Oh, God, that's good.
I want to know what you eat from the streets to the sheets.
So open wide, honey.
I'm coming.
In Yo Mouth.
I got the goosebumps.
Welcome back, folks. Once again, I'm your hostess with the mostest, Munoz. And how are you this Wednesday? How is everyone out there? Hi, it's just me. Me all alone on the pod. Well, let's get down to business. Happy National Pound Cake Day, y'all. Yeah, shout out to you, Little Pound Cake, for all you Drag Race fans. And you know what this got me thinking of? I really wish I had a penchant and the body to be an Instagram thought. Because, listen, your boy Munoz has some cakes, some pound cakes, honey. Okay, okay. I love a good pound cake. I mean, I can't tell you when the last time I had a pound cake was, but I do love, you know what my favorite pound cake was? And I bet you some of you out there can relate to this. Entenmann's. There was nothing like opening a box of like Entenmann's, that white box, breaking the seal and digging into that pound cake. Now I want some pound cake with some like really good coffee. Right? That and Entenmann's coffee crumb cake, even though that's not pound cake, but there was nothing like a fresh Entenmann's. And growing up in Brooklyn where I did, there was an Entenmann's bakery around the block, so we would get it extra fresh. So happy National Pound Cake Day, y'all. And moving on to this day in gay history, in 1971, Village Voice columnist Jill Johnson comes out in her article, Lois Lane is a Lesbian, sparking a controversy between feminism and lesbianism that results in various Johnston antics, including simulating an orgy during a panel discussion moderated by Norman Mailer. All right, all right. Shout out to you, Jill Johnston. All right. And this one was for all the ladies out there. Yes. So I'm coming to you today solito on the pod because I thought it would be really interesting to talk to you about reservations. And I'm not talking about Native American reservations that are slowly dying. We're not even getting that heavy, y'all. And I'm not talking about human reservations, you know. I am talking about restaurant reservations. Now, I'm sure you're thinking to yourself, what the fuck? Like, what is this topic? But if you have you ever really thought about reservations and where reservations come from and why we make reservations and why there was ever a need to make reservations? And this all just came out of the other night we went out to a fabulous new restaurant. Well, it was fabulous and not so fabulous at the same time. It's like the hot new restaurant in Chelsea. And I don't often talk negatively about, actually, I don't really ever talk negatively about places. But we entered this restaurant and it was so weird and we were treated very oddly. And this is kind of, it does domino affected into me thinking about reservations and why we make reservations. So here's the story. Made a 8:15 reservation at this restaurant and we get to the restaurant. Now it was me, friend to the pod, Cedric Lieber Jr. He was on the pod episode 82, I think, and his fiance, Pierre, who is Hamilton on tour. Shout out to you. Yes, we know famous people here on In Yo Mouth. And Pierre's cousin, who is the Latina Marilyn Monroe, giving you, you know, that hourglass figure, mink. Yes, real mink. Let's not kill the animals, but it was a hand-me-down mink cape, bleach blonde hair. So, you know, we all look nice. All the Latin people's out for a nice birthday dinner to celebrate Cedric. And we had an 8:15 reservation that I made. Now, little do you know about your girl Munoz is that probably the only thing that's my biggest pet peeve is being made to wait after you make an appointment of any sort, right? And tardiness and lateness, unless you keep me in the loop that you're going to be late. But if you just take it upon yourself to be late all the time, it really like grinds my gears. But so like waiting at the doctor's office, also my doctor's office knows not to give me an appointment that I'm going to be sitting there 45 minutes waiting at, like, what's the point of making an appointment? What's the point of making a reservation at a certain time if you're not going to be seated at that time? I should have just been a walk-in. You know what I mean out there, folks? Do you know what I mean? Are you picking up what I'm putting down? So here we are, 8:15 reservation. We walk in to the host, and he was like, oh, yes, we have your reservation. There's going to be a little bit of a wait. And I say to him, well, what does that mean? And he goes, well, it's going to be around like 20 minutes or more. And to which I reply, well, then what's the point of making a reservation if we're not being able to be seated at our reservation time? And he like didn't really even apologize about it. He was like, this is what it is. You're going to have to deal with it, which irks me. And listen, I'm in hospitality over 21 years now, 21 years. So I am kind to my hospitality folks. I know what they deal with day in and day out because I am behind the scenes. I am on your side. But there is a point of ridiculousness here, I think, that it's like, oh, we're this hot new place and we're just going to make you wait even though you have a reservation. It was like, well, no. Spending the money that we're about to spend on this very expensive meal, this is not a thing. Not a thing, folks, for anyone, right? So I was like, all right, we're going to wait because it was freezing that night and there was nowhere else to go and we were there. And he suggested that we have a drink at the bar. And I said to him, his back was to the bar. I go, have you seen the bar? The bar was packed to the gills with diners and then other people waiting for tables. So it was like three people deep, including the people dining. So there was no even getting to the bar. I'm a little irked, but I'm still trying to be nice. Folks, we did not get seated till after 9 o'clock. After 9 o'clock. And then upon seating, all right, the waitress was, shout out to you, Sarah, because she was stupendous. She saw that we were frustrated and she immediately just like kind of turned the entire evening around for us. But in that mix of her trying to like turn our experience around, the sommelier comes over with the bottle that Pierre had ordered. And he was like, who ordered this? Now, once again, what kind of way is that to approach a table? And it got me thinking, in hindsight, after we left the restaurant, were we being treated that way because of the way we looked, or was it bad floor management that evening? And then the bigger picture of it all was reservations and why reservations are such a thing. Is it a status thing? Is it like you can claim like, oh, I'm really important because I got this reservation at this really, really nice restaurant that like is the new hot place to be? It's all really interesting, I thought. And so I went a little deep diving into the internet here, and I found this article on The Atlantic, theatlantic.com that Alexis C. Madrigal wrote, Where Restaurant Reservations Come From. And it's from 2014. And this Alexis, much like myself, fell down a hole of why did we start this tradition and where did it even come from? And I'm not going to bore you with a shit ton of like history notes here, but she reached out to a bunch of her friends in the culinary world and culinary historians. And this woman named Rebecca Spang, a Cornell PhD, whose first book was The Invention of the Restaurant, went on to say that reserving a table is not so much an industrial age bolt-on as it's a slippage from the older custom of reserving a room in a restaurant. as her book explains, 18th C caterers either served clients in their homes or in rooms at the Traitors, the first self-styled restaurants borrowed from cafes, having lots of small tables in one big room. Throughout the 19th century, many big restaurants continued to have both a very large public eating room with numerous small private tables and a number of smaller rooms that could be reserved for more private meals, much as some restaurants have special, like, you know, banquet facilities or special occasion rooms today. So, for instance, in Elizabeth Marbury's Manners, a Handbook of Social Customs, which was printed in 1888, we find when a dinner is given at a public restaurant, a table can be reserved in the public dining room or private room can be engaged. And that was a whole nother thing about engaging a table. That was some verbiage that was also being used before restaurant reservations, you know, were a big thing. And so she goes on to say, it is usual to order the dinner beforehand so that there will be no needless delay in serving it when the guests arrive. So, and then Alexis goes on to ask why the practice developed, you know? And the answer was, it boils down to sex and propriety. And Rebecca says, and I quote, I only have an impressionistic sense of this, no quantitative data, but I have the strong feeling that restaurant reservations of the sort described as above, meaning what I just read to you, are also the product of gender imbalance in American cities at the end of the 19th century. Comparatively, a lot of single, affluent men who could not decadently invite single women into their homes, they therefore entertained in restaurants, treating the restaurant as a public extension of their home. See, for instance, Walter Germain's The Complete Bachelor, Manners for Men, printed in 1897. The public restaurant or dining room is the place for a bachelor supper when ladies are guests. A private room is not proper, and your guests want to be seen and see. The same text asserts all meals in a restaurant, unless organized on the spur of a moment, are ordered beforehand and everything including the waiter's tip, arranged and settled for. So basically they're prepaying and how fancy. I kind of wish that still existed, that you, when you made a reservation, everything was pre-ordered. So by the time you sat, they know what you wanted. And I think that would be a really cool concept to bring back. But he goes on to say, if you have not an account at the restaurant, pay the bill at the time you arrange the menu and reserve the table. So what we have in the 19th century is restaurant reservations as a way of hiring a caterer or being able to throw a dinner party in the absence of all the necessary physical and social accoutrements, from the wife and the maidservants to cook, finger bowls, fish knives for 16, etc., etc. And then I found this super interesting. Alexis goes on to ask about the telephone and if the telephone played an important part in kind of the hype of restaurant reserving and the hype of restaurants. And Rebecca goes on to say, as for the telephone, my gut level feeling is that it per se didn't change much, but that its widespread use coincided with a number of pretty important social transformations, such as the post-World War I servant problem. Too many new industrial jobs available, so it was harder to get people to work as servants, and some small but significant shifts in gender relations, flappers and career women. And with lots of men and women working in retail and clerical jobs, there were more people, in cities who depended on restaurants. You know, like things like, that's when like the sandwich counter in a cheap department store or diners became more popular. For at least one meal a day, you know, this is what this working class and everybody working across the board and gender norms shifting was creating. So there was real change in the culture of eating out in the 1920s and 1930s, but it wasn't driven by the telephone. Rebecca goes on to say, it is my intuition, as I briefly said in the last message, that what you're really looking at is the emergence of widespread daily competitive consumption in the 1950s, and then it's mammoth-sizing in the 1980s. Such social phenomena didn't start till after World War II. So, but they were diagnosed in the 1890s, you know, and then just more and more so becoming part of mass culture in the 1950s. So interesting, isn't it? Like, who thought of this? Only me, or who thinks of this? Only me and Alexis, apparently. And so we think of it because you don't have to. You know, Rebecca goes on to finally say, I would be inclined to say that the most important technological change in terms of restaurant reservations has been how restaurants' reviews are written and disseminated. Without those, 95% of diners, at least, would have little idea of where they wanted to go. And one good review, of course, steers everybody who reads it to a particular restaurant, where it then becomes very difficult to get reservations, hence boosting its status. The logic of all that, it must be good. Everybody wants to go there. You know, there's that famous Sex in the City scene where they're sitting at that restaurant. What was it called? I forget. You all know out there that I am really not a Sex in the City person, but I do know that scene where they're fighting with that woman and they're drinking Cosmos waiting for a table reservation. But how interesting is that? How interesting is that? So once again, I think kind of they kind of point, Rebecca and Alexis kind of point to my fact of it kind of being a little bit of status, you know, status boosting. And oh, we got the restaurant reservation and we're eating here tonight. But it's really, really interesting. And this just sparked, this all just being sparked from the way we were treated at this one restaurant in Chelsea. That's the hot new place. And I wrote a strongly worded letter, but I thought it was very, very clear just about the way we were treated and how it was such a shame because it definitely dampened the experience of the meal. And the meal was exceptional. And no, I'm not going to name the restaurants out there, you people, right? Because I that's not my MO. But I do want to talk about just this like reservation culture and the way some restaurants, some establishments feel that they can treat you just because of their status in the restaurant world or who they think they are. I know because I've made a bunch of reservations at Le Bernardin for people and for employers. I've never been, but you know, Le Bernardin, you call them, they pick up the phone, they put you on hold, and I'm convinced that there is a manual for these reservationists to be like, okay, you pick up the phone on the second ring, and then you greet them, but then you have to put them on hold for like a minute, and then you tell them that you ask them about their reservation requirements, and then you give them the rundown of the men need to be in coats and the women need to look like this and so on and so forth. And it's this like whole process. But I bet you, like, if I walk into a Bernardin, I am sure as hell going to be like, well, for all this that you put me through, my table better be ready and I better be sitting at 8:15 on the dot and not waiting 20 minutes. Like, it's a big pet peeve. I think I think there's a lack of respect in it, you know, and I am not here for it, folks. I am just not here for it. And I did tell this restaurant that it's a shame because the meal was so good and that waitress was so stellar, and we definitely tipped her and tipped her well because she did turn our night around. She was great, great, great. She even got rid of that not so nice sommelier and sent somebody else over who was also really fantastic. And which also goes to show you that, you know, the important part, waiters and waitresses and, you know, or if we're not gendering them these days, you know, our wait staff in general, how much they play in the experience of the meal and how they can take a situation and completely turn it around for you, good or bad, really, and the importance to stress that, you know, to treat your wait staff well and with respect, and a little humanity goes a long way, you know, and that comes from both sides of the field here. And that's my take on reservations. I'm curious about how you all feel out there about reservations and this reservation culture. I know when I started telling people about this story and what happened to us at this restaurant and how I started to think, I was like, oh, was it because we were Latin, we look like Latin people eating at a very fancy restaurant? Was it that, or was it bad management? And then the difference between LA reservation culture and how it's somewhat expected that you like are going to wait no matter what if you have a reservation or not, and New York reservation culture where it's like, oh no, honey, we do not wait. We made a reservation. You know, I made this reservation weeks in advance and we don't wait. And does that make me sound like an entitled biatch? Maybe, but I don't think so, right? Because I'm not asking for any more than what you've offered me, you know? So entitlement, I think not. Just, I think it's good practice to, if we're paying hundreds of dollars for a meal, to, you know, space your reservations out. Is that too much to ask? You know, hire. There are talented hosts out there that are career hosts and hostesses, host people, you know how to do this and space them out and seat people. And if you're a little tight and they're taking walk-ins, they're like, well, sorry, folks, we have a reservation. We need this table back by this time. You're a walk-in. You know, you should have made a reservation. How do you all feel about this? How do you all feel about this? I'm curious. I would love to hear about it. You know, you can always write me on at inyomouthnyc@gmail.com. Or you can go to Insta and Twitter and tweet me or write me through there. Slide into my DMs at InYoMouthPod. I'd love to hear what you think. And with that, I think now would be a great time for my favorite part and your favorite part of the pod, a little bit of food news update.
Food news.
Ooh, honey, you ain't ready,
girl. Spill the tea.
News update.
Joseph Colomb, who opened the first Trader Joe's in 1987, has passed away. I know, womp womp. Not a very happy pod today. Sorry, folks. Yeah, I just felt like, you know, giving Joseph a bit of a shout out on the pod because I'm a big Trader Joe's fan. PS.com. We did, back when Marie was on the pod, we did this whole Trader Joe's, like inside secrets to Trader Joe's. And, you know, if you buy something at Trader Joe's and you don't like it, you can return it. And I just had some of that everything but the elote seasoning, which is supposed to mimic elote corn, the Mexican corn. It wasn't good. I found it pasty, but I'm going to return it. But, you know, there were 19 Trader Joe's stores when Colomb retired back in 1988. There wasn't much more to say about this, but the man has passed away, and he's given us one of the major supermarket chains that I feel like everybody has come to love, from Two Buck Chuck to all cauliflower gnocchi. This man created something much, much beloved and so, so large. So I just wanted to give him a little shout out and a little moment of silence here on Food News Update. Martha Stewart is hosting a new show that will make bakers compete in boot camp challenges. Yes, could you imagine Martha Stewart as your like boot camp sergeant? That would be ridiculous. Because you know Martha Stewart is not fucking with you. She's just not, right? So apparently the Food Network just revealed to People that the station has finished filming a new reality cooking competition with Martha. It's called Bakeaway Camp with Martha Stewart. Yes. So apparently this is not like your standard reality baking show. It features six amateur bakers who go on a culinary retreat with outdoor elements. Look at that. Bakeaway Camp with Martha Stewart is unlike anything viewers have seen before, with Martha personally guiding and mentoring these home bakers through challenges as well as the most unpredictable outdoor elements. I could only imagine seeing these people like run up hills with like 40-pound bags of flour as Martha in combat boots, you know, is screaming at them. Or like if one of them like falls into the mud, Martha just presses her boot into their face. Oh my goodness. An air date hasn't been announced yet, but I am here for it. I am here for it. If y'all haven't seen the Martha and Snoop baking show or whatever that's called, where they just essentially get high and cook shit, it's that shit is good TV. I am here for anything Martha Stewart these days. I don't know about you, but I will be watching. Doctors warn people to stop shoving potatoes up their butts. I am not even kidding about this article that I found on this brand new website called The Takeout. Go check them out. Shout out to you, The Takeout. But apparently the New York Post reported that people are too embarrassed to seek medical help for hemorrhoids, and they have been turning to the internet for answers. And the internet, God love the internet, has been telling people to shove raw potatoes up their asses. Yep, you know what? For all the things that have been up my butt or that I've wanted up my butt, a raw potato is not one of them. So Allison Robicelli, who wrote this article, shout out to you, decided to fact check this. And believe it or not, this is true, right? She goes, I am absolutely horrified to report that, yes, the internet proposes that people put potatoes up their posteriors to palliate the painful piles that have proliferated from pregnancy, portliness, or pressure. So the basic idea is that cold raw potato slices ostensibly soothe inflamed tissues around the hemorrhoid, and that the astringent properties of potato can in theory relieve the pain and itching associated with the condition. Oh my goodness, guys. Oh my goodness. She goes on to like question medical professionals that are friends of hers, and everyone's like, the medical literature does not support the use of rectally inserted potatoes for the treatment of hemorrhoids. It should be said that potatoes are non-toxic when used in this way per se. However, there is a risk of pain, injury to rectal tissues from the cold temperature, and the risk of an embarrassing emergency room visit due to a stuck potato up your ass. I mean, what? What is wrong with people? What is wrong with people? You know, listen, I've watched some videos out there. I think we've all seen Two Girls, One Cup. Remember that. But why are you shoving crazy things up your butt? Up your butt. Another doctor says, a cut potato does not have enzymes that reduce this. The moisture of the vagina and rectum facilitate decomposition of the potato. You can't put anything up your ass, but it doesn't make it a suppository. Well, truer words have never been spoken. Folks, just go to the fucking doctor and get your hemorrhoids taken care of. I mean, that's what doctors are there for. And make sure when you make an appointment, you ask the receptionist, is it a real 8:15 appointment? Or does that 8:15 mean I'm going to be seen at 9 o'clock? Because my appointment maker at my doctor's office, she's great. She's like, no, it's a real one. She goes, or she'll be like, no, come in half an hour later. That's a really busy day. So yes. And with that, I think this is a great way to A, not put potatoes up your ass, and B, to end food news update. Yeah. Guys, I know I ended food news update, but I'm still a little stuck on people shoving potatoes up their butts to cure their hemorrhoids. What? Ever? I mean, I guess we've talked about this with, I guess, Dr. Zagragan, or maybe back on another Valentine's Day episode where people are putting weird things inside them, you know, for sexual purposes. But I mean, what? Talk about homeopathic medicine, huh? Oh, my goodness. Anyways, I thought it would be a really great way to kind of wrap this reservations podcast up to research what are the hardest restaurants still to get reservations at. And according to OpenTable, OpenTable says that Sushi Ginza Onodera in New York City, Atera, these are all New York restaurants. Cote is a steakhouse. The Polo Bar. Balthazar, I found really interesting. And I'm curious if that's still from the Sex in the City effect or not. So I didn't realize Balthazar was still like the hopping place and hard to get a reservation at. Danielle, obviously. Yeah, Danielle Boulud's restaurant. Zenkichi. Lots of Asian restaurants. I love that. I love that for New York. I love that for people. Yes, Westlight. A lot of these I haven't heard of either. Lavara, El Cortez. Thank you for a Mexican restaurant on that list. Open Table. And then according to the Daily News, Bennu in San Francisco can't get a reservation. Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair. Comey in Washington, D.C. Momofuku Ko in New York City. I didn't realize that was still a thing either, but apparently, I guess so. Oh, there's a Momofuku that was a gay bar before it was Momofuku. If those diners only knew that, like, the things that went on in that space before it was a Momofuku. Lord, if those walls could talk, right? And Naka in Los Angeles. What else? There's an advertisement. Per se, I mean, that's like a $500 a head meal then. Lord, if anyone can get a reservation at Per se for me and then pay for the meal, I will gladly take it. I had the pleasure of meeting Chef Thomas Keller and trying some of his food at an event. He's amazing. Love him. Shout out to you. Hi. Rayo's in New York City. Yep. That's still a thing, right? Schwa in Chicago. Tallulah's Table in Pennsylvania. Okay. All right. The French Laundry. Yep. Another Thomas Keller. Oh my God. Could you imagine being like head chef of like, or Thomas Keller? You're making bank and your restaurants are still like hard to get reservations at. Traumeric, what else? And that's it, folks. That is it. Yeah, so I just kind of wanted to bring you a short little pod on this lovely Wednesday. The weather's getting nicer. People are going out more. You know, I was talking to my friend Michael on the phone today about this, and I also found that my friends and I are making more and more reservations. And I was like, did we cross a threshold as we're getting older that like, oh, now we're men of a certain age, or people of a certain age, I should say, and now we like make reservations everywhere we go? It's like a thing. And like, we're not even trying to be like fancy about it. It's just like open table points, and we just want to be guaranteed a table because we're old, and we just want to sit and eat and not have to think about it. How do you feel about that? Are you finding that this is like a generational thing that like you reach you reach a certain age and you start making reservations? Or have you always made reservations? Or do you just fly by the seat of your pants and live dangerously and never make reservations at all? Or do you not go to fancy places that take reservations to begin with? Because I'm finding that I'm making reservations everywhere I can at this point, if only for the points and a guaranteed seat. You know, it's even so much so that at one point in my life, there's a restaurant here in New York City called Empanada Mama. So delicious. Shout out to you, Empanada Mama. But it was a tiny restaurant and now it's much bigger. But I had this waitress is now the GM phone number. She gave it to me and I would text her because they didn't take reservations. It was first comes first serve. And I would text her 45 minutes before I wanted to come and she would put me on the list and then have my table ready. Now that is some shit, honey. Yes, like you gotta know people. Anywho, folks, have any interesting reservation stories? Let me know. Y'all don't talk to me, and I know you listen out there, because I see the analytics. You're definitely listening, and that's great. I'm excited about it. New things in the works for your girl Munoz out there, you know. If you like what I do and you haven't checked out my writings for West 42nd Street Magazine, you can go to W42ST, that stands for West 42nd Street.com, and find their issue and read my monthly food article there. That's a lot of fun. I'm starting to do more with them. Some brands are reaching out, so you'll see some of more of that stuff on my personal Instagram at The Kitchen Gailey. That's Gailey with a G, not Daily with a D, because Daily with a D goes duh, not ja. And if you didn't get that Liza with a Z reference, shame on you. I'm going to need you to go to confession or at least put yourself in timeout for half an hour. And there's a new site about to go up, themunoz.com. That's the M-U-N-O-Z.com. Check out what I've been doing. See, learn a little bit more about your hostess with the mostest. And the blog is yet again once going back up. And you can find that there, The Kitchen Gailey. Lots of new things in the new year. I'm consolidating things and revamping things and forging ahead. So talk to me, folks. Talk to me, because I'd love to hear from you. Ask me questions, even if it's not podcast related. I'm here for you. I'm your go-to queer, you know, voice in food. So let me have it. Let me have it. Give me your opinions. And with that, like I always say, or like I've started to say, without you, I would be nothing, right? I do this for you, and of course I do this for me, but I'm really here for the people. So thank you always for your support, and thank you for listening to In Yo Mouth.